Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Bill Parker and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the East West Institute in New York City. I'd like to welcome you to another edition of the EWI podcast where we explore some of today's most critical global issues with leading thinkers, influencers, and analysts. We encourage you to check out our previous podcasts available on our website at www.eastwest.ngo. Today, I'm pleased to be speaking with Dr. Jeremy Suri, a renowned professor and historian who this year released his newest book titled The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Jeremy is the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs. He has a PhD in history from Yale University and is a professor and prolific author. This is the 10th book that he has published. Welcome, Jeremy. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's jump right into it. Why exactly do you consider the American presidency impossible?
The President of the United States is the most important executive in our world today, and he has so much responsibility, and the tools at his disposal give him the opportunity to do many small things, but not enough of the big things that are necessary to succeed as president.
That's interesting. So when we look at issues like the 2,000 plus political appointees that need to be approved, is that one example that you're talking about?
Absolutely. It's one of many cases where the president has to manage a huge bureaucracy that ends up managing him, and also where the range of problems that he confronts go well beyond his area of expertise and, quite frankly, his area of priorities.
Now, I just came back from Monticello not too long ago, and you reflect upon the fact that the founding fathers had a very different perspective of what the presidency should look like. So how do we get to this present situation?
So the point I make in my book is that the history tells us more than the individual decision makers themselves. Over time, presidents have taken on more responsibility, not because they wanted to, but because the world brought more responsibility to them. And that has deformed the office. This is the historical insight. Our offices develop in ways that reflect the times we're in, not always our priorities. And so we've moved away from, I think, an appropriate vision of the president as a unifier, as a strategic thinker, as someone focusing on the big issues, to the president as fire chief and police officer for the world. And that's made it, especially in a diplomatic context, very difficult for the president to pursue American national interests and, quite frankly, larger global interests.
So I found it interesting that you write that each subsequent president's calendar has become more and more packed and with activities and demands on their time, especially after President Roosevelt. What happened around that time? Did it have to do with the expansion of government, or was it simply a desire to be more hands-on, micromanage, to consolidate their power? What was it?
Well, this is one of the real fun parts about doing research. We get to go back to the original materials and really try to reconstruct what it was like to be Franklin Roosevelt, to be John F. Kennedy. And one of the best ways to do this, I found, was to go back to their calendars. And we have, Bill, every day of every president from Herbert Hoover through Barack Obama. We can see how they spent their time. And what's extraordinary, and I show this in the book where I've actually provided pictures of the calendars, Franklin Roosevelt's calendar, he had a lot of big issues, but he had a lot of time to think and time to gather people around him, many of whom didn't work for him, to ask them questions, to solicit their input, and then to go away and make the decision that had to be made. You look at John F. Kennedy just 20 years later, 20 years from Pearl Harbor to the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it's a totally different world. The calendar's typed up, it's down to the minute, everything is prearranged. And when the Cuban Missile Crisis begins, especially that first week when it's still secret, Kennedy barely has time to get into the meetings to discuss what to do about the missiles in Cuba. His schedule is so full. Why is that? It's because after World War II, the president is not just a commander-in-chief and chief diplomat for the United States. He's the center of world diplomatic, military, strategic activities. Roosevelt really has to worry about half a dozen to a dozen countries in terms of main interlocutors. For John F. Kennedy, there are more than 100 countries he's thinking about as we're thinking about the Cold War and we're worried about communist infiltration. So the range and complexity of issues makes it very difficult for presidents to keep their eye on the ball.
Certainly agree with you on Kennedy's time as the Cuban Missile Crisis was going on. And as we read the book, The Kennedy Tapes,
yes,
and you can see that in there in
precisely
great detail as we talk
precisely
about the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's interesting to me that these time changes, these watershed events, are around media. And when I say that, This is about the time, Kennedy is about the time that we really started getting into television heavily.
Yes.
Do you think there's an impact there, and do you think there's an impact today on social media when we look at Facebook and Twitter and other social media?
Fantastic question. Absolutely. One of the things we see is that the media provide presidents and other leaders with opportunities to communicate they didn't have before. But quite often, the press of media communication distorts what leaders are doing. Another way of saying that is, the point I try to make in the book, is that leadership is always about telling a story. An executive of a large country or a large set of global projects and global policies has to be able to tell a story about why we're doing what we're doing. Presidents spend more and more time responding to questions rather than agenda setting. And I think that's not because of the technology, it's because of the speed and the inclination to respond rather than to think. And one of the points I'm making in the book is that we get presidents over time who are great tactical responders to crisis, but not great strategic thinkers beyond crisis. They are keeping the boat afloat. That's how they get elected. They get elected by proving to various different constituencies that they can solve short-term problems, but they're leaving the long-term problems on the table.
Over the last 20 years or so, I've been offering the point that the United States does not have a true grand strategy. Now, when I looked at President Xi's recent 19th Party Congress, out of that came 14 points, and they are very strategic. And do you think that that is their grand strategy and that the United States needs a similar approach? Or do you think that's even possible with the election process as it is right now, where every 2 years you're running for re-election if you're a congressman?
Well, it's much harder in a democratic system. This is a point that George Kennan made 80 years ago, right? That actually democratic systems have more frequent transitions, as you said, Bill, and there's less consistency, and there's always a desire to please more people. President Xi Jinping has a broad group of people he has to please, but not the same number that the President of the United States has to please, or that even a congressman has to please. So yes, that is an issue, but I think there's something deeper. I think what distinguishes President Xi today is that he came into office with a plan in his mind, it seems to me. He had a strategy he brought with him. This is the old point that Henry Kissinger made, that those at the top of the food chain don't have time to learn what they haven't already learned. It's what you bring to the table. And we tend to elect people, this is what makes the office impossible, we tend to elect people in our system now who are able at doing lots of little things for lots of groups, not doing the big things that matter the most for our country. That's about the way we choose our leaders, but it's also about the structure of the office itself. It's in perpetual crisis mode, and the strategic planning process has not worked in a long time, as you know better than anyone, Bill.
So let me ask you this. When pundits point out perceived errors in domestic and foreign policy making, should we be pointing a finger at institutional flaws in the executive branch of our government or simply poor leadership?
Well, I think it's all of the above in a certain way. We have had poor leadership and we have had institutional flaws, but I think it comes back to your point. If you don't have a strategy, if you don't know what you're about, it's hard to set appropriate priorities. There are too many crises every day for the United States to respond to. We have to not let the crisis of the moment define us. We have to define the crises. So let's take North Korea, for example. Today, the person making American policy in East Asia is Kim Jong-un, not the President of the United States, because we don't have a strategy. I'm not saying this is easy, but this is actually, if it's a priority for us, it has to be part of a broader strategic discussion. And our leaders in our system have proven historically that they can initiate these conversations if they put the effort into it and if they make the office serve the needs of strategy, not the other way around. The next great president will be someone who reforms the office to make the office more strategic. Eisenhower, Roosevelt, and Truman did this in the early Cold War. It's time to do it again. It's going to look different. Maybe we don't need an NSC. Maybe we need something different. Maybe we don't need a JCS. Maybe we need something different. We went through all of those reforms 80 years ago. My argument is we need to undertake a series of reforms like that today.
Interesting. So you think the revolution in business affairs, those types of approaches that were at least tried 20, 25 years ago are the types of things we need to look at again, Goldwater Nichols, et cetera?
Absolutely. I think we need that more than ever. And that would also give Congress more of a productive role to play in this.
Now, I'll tell you, I went through and read your book, and I read it a second time, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and I found it absolutely interesting and very insightful. You mention in there that a president's style or personality influences their administration. How does a president create a new model of national leadership in their vision, which you're just kind of getting at?
Yes, I think it involves a number of things, and I think we're ready for this. First of all, we need to get beyond this discussion of insider versus outsider. As I try to show in the first half of the book, the great leaders we have had brought knowledge from outside of politics. They all did. Abraham Lincoln spent most of his career outside of politics. Theodore Roosevelt as well. They brought knowledge from outside of politics, but they also understood how the sausage was made. You need to be an insider and an outsider at the same time. And our world is still too divided, Bill, between the public servants and the private sector. And we need to have more cross movement in between the two. We need to build that into people's careers earlier on. And we need a leader who will model that for us and will bring that knowledge basis. And I do believe, and I make this point in the book, character matters. Character is not destiny. But you lead by showing people in your actions what you believe, not just by what you say.
Very interesting. So you say the insiders and the outsiders. You also make the statement that the office is almost too big, almost makes it too busy for one human being. So when we look at the current presidency, we sort of have an insider and an outsider. The insider being the Vice President Pence, who was a governor, who understands how government runs, et cetera. And then you have the outsider, who was a businessman, President Trump. Do you think that kind of combination with the president and the vice president, assuming that they get along, and I was at a dinner with the vice president just last week, and it seems like they get along very well. So do you think a relationship like that is what is needed between the president and vice president?
So I do make an argument in the book, as you know, that we should consider a more divided executive. And every other democracy in the world does this. And perhaps having the vice president play a kind of COO role makes a lot of sense. The problem is no one elects the vice president. The vice president doesn't have legitimacy. The president is elected. Vice presidents can only hurt you when you're running for office. The only known case where a vice presidential candidate helped the president get elected was Lyndon Johnson delivering Texas for John F. Kennedy. So there's a legitimacy problem there, and that affects Pence's influence as vice president when he's dealing with Congress, of course, especially if Congress happens to be of a different party, which it might be at some point in the future. I think having someone with inside knowledge and having someone with outside knowledge is not the way to go. I think we need people who have both. I think that needs to be embodied in both of them. Let me put it this way. You wouldn't send commanders out, or you wouldn't send a unit, a military unit out and say, okay, we're going to have one guy at the top of the unit who has no military experience at all, and he's going to have below him someone who has lots of military experience. The guy at the top needs to know how the sausage is made, needs to know the basics of battle tactics, as does the number two person. So I think what we need to have are people who bring different kinds of experience from both public and private in each of their careers to office.
So that's interesting. So if we look at the U.S. military today, you have about 1.37 million people in the military, but you have 325 million people in the country, which means that less than one half of 1% of the population is serving on active duty. You have a much smaller percentage that are serving in the Foreign Service. So let's say it's 2% or 1.5%, something like that. It's a very small number. Do you think that national service is something that would help us in the next generation of leaders? Or do you think national service is a bad idea because it shouldn't be mandatory? And I look at a country like Israel that has national service, and it seems to work well for them. But what works well for one country may not work well for another. What do you think?
I have come to believe, based on my research, it's not where I started out, and it's not where my politics are, but I think the research leads me to believe that not only would we be better off with national service, we might need it. It might be essential for our future. Why do I say that? Because what's clear in my research is that in various prior periods of crisis, our country moved forward because people of great talent not only had public experience, understood and valued public service, and it was through their public service that they gained contact and connection with people who were so different than they are. What we struggle with today, it seems to me, is we struggle with the siloing of our lives. that I can find the 10 people who think exactly what I think all across the world, we can have a conversation and not talk to anyone who thinks differently. Public service, national service of some form, forces you to commit to the public for a time, forces you to value that, and it forces you to connect with people you wouldn't otherwise. Let's take the Civilian Conservation Corps for an example that Franklin Roosevelt created. It wasn't even his idea. He experimented with it. Millions of American men between ages 18 and 27 went and served in these camps where they were building pathways in national parks, planting trees, and they were with people who were so different from themselves. When you read their oral histories of their service in World War II, they all refer to their CCC experience before boot camp. It prepared them to be part of serving their country, it prepared them to work with people. Why did we win World War II? We were better team players than the enemy. We're not better team players today.
Industry helped a little bit, too.
Yeah, industry helped a little bit, but I'm talking more in terms of our soldiers, as you know, were not better trained on December 6th, 1941, but they knew how to work with their fellow citizen in a time of crisis in battle. And I think we need to reinstill that in our society. And I think there are many ways we could do that. We could make it mandatory, but boy, oh boy, we could have leaders who inspire that. I'm trying to do this. I know EWI is, too. I'm now telling my students, this is your generational calling. I want my most talented students to wait to go to some of the professional opportunities they have. I want them to go serve their country for a few years. And I tell them it's going to be a dirty experience. People are going to attack you. But you know what? Prior generations stood up against bullets to defend our country. It's time for you to be all in as well.
So how do you see the presidency evolving in years to come?
I think we're going to see, I'm optimistic, Bill, I think we're going to see a new generation of younger Americans getting involved in politics. I think that's happening on both sides or on various sides of the political spectrum. And they're fed up. These are people of integrity and intelligence who care about building a peaceful world through diplomacy, what EWI does better than anyone else. They care about economic growth and economic opportunity. They care about the environment. And they will embody a new model of leadership as we saw it during World War II, as we saw after the Vietnam War. I think we'll see that again. And I think in a certain way, the mess we're in now is inspiring these individuals to serve. I have five students of mine running for Congress now. Three of them are military veterans. Actually, four of them are veterans. They've come back from Afghanistan and Iraq. And they've said, you know, my service is not done. It's time for me to get involved. Three of them are ladies. I think we're going to see a more diverse crop of people of integrity and intelligence running for office, and that's going to change our politics. That's how institutions change.
I couldn't agree with you more, and as I work with the East-West Institute, my time in the military, a full career of that, just coming back from the College of Charleston today, these are very encouraging times as I look at the young people. When you talk about the greatest generation, I really think this generation could be the greatest generation because these are people that have decided to serve their country at a time that they knew they were likely going to war.
Yes.
Because we were in Iraq, we were in Afghanistan, we're around the world in a mess. But there are others serving in many other ways, so I look forward to watching the next generation make us a better country.
And if I might say so, I think that should inspire all of us to do what we can to help them. My concern is we're not. But we could do much more as a society to encourage young people to get involved.
I couldn't agree with you more. Again, today we're here with Dr. Jeremy Suri. His book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. If you haven't read it, you really need to get out there and read it. Also, take a look at our website. There's a lot in there as we tie in these issues with major contributors like Dr. Suri, who is here today. It was a real pleasure having you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.